Good morning. It is Easter Sunday, March 31st, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda. KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, featuring American Chronicles, The Art of Norman Rockwell, on exhibit until May 27th. The museum opens at 11 a.m. daily, except Tuesdays. Tickets and information about Rockwell-related programming is available online at crystalbridges.org.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, one of the oldest watering holes in the area prepares to reopen. And we have previews of a new museum exhibit and a month of theater.
But first, farmers markets are preparing to open, and we are beginning to think about spring and summer vegetables and fruits. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums has this story about a summer staple, the strawberry.
You know the strawberries you buy at local farmers markets are grown near you, but what about the berries you buy elsewhere? Chances are those strawberries were grown in California, Florida, or Mexico. The overwhelming majority of the 2.3 billion pounds of strawberries grown in the U.S. in 2011 came from a handful of counties in California or Florida. But a $3 million donation from the Walmart Foundation to the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture is designed to be a research seed to boost strawberry production in the middle of the country.
Well, Arkansas has a long history of strawberry production. In fact, a white county. Mm-hmm. And Bald Knob used to be consider itself one of the strawberry capitals of the United States.
Kurt Rome is a professor of horticulture at the University of Arkansas and a co-director of the Center for Agricultural and Rural Sustainability. The center will manage a national grants program charged with awarding money from the donation to public universities with programs designed to improve strawberry growth in the places like Arkansas. Arkansas did consider itself a champion of the strawberry industry once. In fact, the University of Arkansas had a strawberry breeding program, but Kurt Rome says it was discontinued more than 20 years ago. He says the strawberry production system in Arkansas was a perennial cropping system.
So you'd plant strawberries and you'd cultivate them and you'd grow them as a continuous crop that might last 6 to 9 years. But in the 1980s, some new technologies came up. They were developed mostly on the West Coast, and it was based on some entire new genetics for strawberries. Strawberries only flower once a year. The traditional strawberry only flowers once a year, and therefore it would only produce in the spring for a very short period of maybe 3 or 4 weeks. There were some breakthrough in genetics, which allowed strawberries to be continually flowering, continuously blooming, so therefore continuously cropping.
So those new genetic findings led to an annual culture. Strawberries grown in plastic and high-density rows. The planting was in the fall, and the cropping began when temperatures were appropriate and would last until temperatures became too hot. This new system produced about 100,000 pounds of strawberries per acre compared to the older method that produced only between 10 and 15,000 pounds per acre. The conditions best suited for the new system are primarily met in only a few counties in California and Florida. Arkansas and other strawberry-producing states in the middle of America couldn't compete.
So what happened in Arkansas and the majority of the United States where we had traditional strawberry industries, all of a sudden they just disappeared as these large commercial industries in California and Florida blossomed.
The $3 million from the Walmart Foundation is intended to aid in bringing back the strawberry to places it had been flourishing. More strawberries grown in the interior of the country can lead to a more sustainable industry. Kurt Rome says since almost all of U.S. strawberries come from the edges of the continent, there are problems getting the fruit from field to grocery shelf.
There are industry standards that say that the average strawberry travels somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 miles from the farm to the kitchen table. And there's some other challenges in that because strawberries only survive maybe 7 to 10 days after they're harvested. When you spend the first 5 days of your life on a truck, by the time consumers get them, they might not be in very good quality or they don't last to consumers. And so that's another sustainability issue is the spoilage. There's a huge spoilage through the supply chain.
The Center for Agricultural and Rural Sustainability is seeking proposals from land-grant and public universities to increase strawberry production. Heather Frederick, project manager of this program, says the center wants to become partners with researchers who are conducting work aimed at a wide variety of growers.
Projects that we will be supporting, we hope that they affect growers of all sizes, not just the larger scale ones, but, you know, even farmers market producers, so they can bring more strawberries to the farmers markets, or send the, or sell them to the grocery stores, or even Walmart if they choose, or another larger supermarket chain.
Kurt Rome, the co-director of the Center for Agriculture and Rural Sustainability, says the big question to be addressed is whether the strawberry can be reintroduced as a more local crop by adapting the technologies that are already known to exist.
So we're soliciting the best ideas from across the United States. And we're hoping that we can stimulate innovation, education, outreach, and really kind of technology transfer ways. So part of the kind of working hypothesis that the directors for the Center of Agriculture Rural Sustainability, Heather and I, have is that a lot of the technology to grow strawberries exists. It's been studied at universities across the United States, but it's not been moved from the laboratory and the research farm to the production field. So the goal of this project is to give grants to land-grant universities and state-supported public universities to do that technology transfer, to see if we can actually move known technology and stimulate additional innovation and moving that from university into producers' fields.
If this works for strawberries, he says, maybe similar programs could be developed for tomatoes or peaches to help farmers make those crops more sustainable as well. That word, sustainable, applies to many of the facets of this program, from the shorter transportation routes required to get the fruit to consumers to the ability of farmers to make a living.
And we want it to be socially sustainable. So we hope to have impact on families and communities in very positive ways.
And even for people who don't eat strawberries or grow them, Heather Frederick, the project manager, says the mere existence of the program helps ignite conversations about food origins and how food is grown.
This absolutely plays into knowing where your food comes from, knowing how far it's traveled, whether it's, you know, from 3,000 miles away or 300 or just 30, you know. It's being able to make decisions informed. It's being able to make informed decisions.
The first grants are expected to be announced in May, the month that is, as it turns out, recognized as National Strawberry Month. You can learn more about the project at strawberry.uark.edu.
Staple watering holes in the area that have survived the test of time. Rogers Rack and George's on Dixon Street in Fayetteville have both gone through some changes, but they're still there. And Chelsea's in Eureka Springs is a place you can always count on. Maxine's Tap Room in Fayetteville is one of those places. It's been around for over 60 years. Opened in 1950 by Maxine, it didn't move to its current location on Block Street until the 1960s, but that's still quite a while. When Maxine passed away in 2006, her family took over the business, but a fire in 2007 put them back a bit. On April Fool's Day, Monday, Maxine's will reopen once again. It's undergone a bit of a facelift, and a new management team is in place, but residents and patrons rest assured that it will maintain its historical charm. Local small business owner Hannah Withers is one of four who are remodeling and reopening Maxine's.
It's tricky to sort of try and revitalize a place that has so many stories and legends. I mean, Maxine was a Fayetteville icon, and everybody has a story about her. She was in this bar for 60 years, sitting in her stool from open to close every day that it was here, and she was a character. She was cantankerous. And
Andrea Foran is just one of many that has memories of this place. Maxine was her great aunt.
Growing up, if you wanted to see Maxine, we didn't go to her house. We went to the tap room. I mean, I remember going there when I was 4 years old playing the ding ding, and Maxine would boot all the frat guys off because the kids had came into play, me and my cousins and stuff. And so, I mean, it's just always, you know, it was different back then, though, too, with kids being in bars and everything. But I just always grew up going in there, and it's just always been a part of not only my life, but my whole family's life.
Though Maxine's will remain in the family, the name, business, and building have been leased to Hannah, her husband Ben, and longtime friends and fellow small business owners, Rebecca and Matt Champagne. Rebecca has a few memories of her own.
Sure I do. I don't know if I want to share them. Yeah, I moved to Fayetteville when I was 21, so that was prime, you know, having a beer at Maxine's age. And this was a favorite of some friends of mine back in the day. But I remember it always being really smoky, and so I always remember I would come in for a PBR and have about enough. So the fact that it's non-smoking now, I'm actually pretty excited about it. I think that I personally would spend more time in here.
No worries for smokers. They plan to build a back porch in the coming weeks for smokers and non alike. Running a business is hard work. Running a lasting business is even harder work. I asked Andrea why she thinks Maxine's has survived for over 60 years.
For so many years, it was her. It was Maxine. I mean, Maxine is what, for years and years, what brought people there. I remember whenever Maxine got kind of sick, you know, down in her later years, and stopped being at the bar every night, people literally poke their head in, not see her on her stool, and leave. You know, so for years, it was just Maxine. It was her characters, her personality. It was the atmosphere that was created by her being there. You know, it wasn't somewhere that people could get out of hand or act unruly and it would be tolerated. You know, she had a very, you know, just a way and persona that she wanted the bar to be. And it was that 100% with her there.
She saw something in Hannah, Rebecca, and their team that made her confident that they would carry on the good name of Maxine while maintaining a successful business. They own Little Bread Company and Terra Tots, respectively. Andrea saw their drive and their passion for Block Street.
Anybody that knows Hannah and knows what she has done for Block Street and the businesses on Block Street, her enthusiasm is contagious. I mean, she is so excited, her and Rebecca both, to see their excitement and for them to walk in Maxine's and see potential that I've seen for so many years, but I'm not personally in a position to be able to do those things. For that team of people to come in and see all that potential and have the drive and energy and time to do it was really just what, it's just a good fit for them and it's a good fit for us.
Hannah and her husband Ben like to put on their potential glasses when they go into local businesses that have been around for a while. They look around and dream about what they would do with a place if it was theirs. They did this while cooling off in Maxine's last summer.
So I think at Block Party last year, Ben and I sat down and he kept saying, is that a skylight in the ceiling? Why are they hiding the skylight? I mean, what's underneath all these popcorn ceilings? And Ben's the dreamer in our relationship. I'm a little bit more of the executor that makes those dreams sort of morph into a reality. But
the popcorn ceilings are gone. The skylight has been opened up, letting in some natural light. The Formica bar has been turned into copper. Rebecca's husband owns Hammer and Chisel and has been doing all the work along with Ben. The bathrooms have new fixtures, wallpaper. But they do intend to maintain the history of the building. Andrea and her family have saved everything over the years and have allowed Hannah and her team access.
And so we have photographs of the original building in 1950. We have pictures of Maxine standing on block with her sister in her pillbox hat and 1950s pearls and the ding ding machine.
A picture of Maxine's first bartender already hangs on the wall, as does her stool, red vinyl with her name embroidered in black. Maxine's picture hangs on the door of the women's restroom. And a deer head that's been around for decades will hang over a round red booth in a front corner. The ding ding machine is currently under repair, which has been difficult. I didn't know what a ding ding machine was, so I asked Andrea, Maxine's great niece, what it is.
It's such a iconic thing for Maxine's because it was always a part. I mean, from 1950 until it was taken out in probably 2006, around in there, it was always in there. Like I said, I remember being 4 years old and playing the ding ding. People who don't know what it is, I mean, it was about a 12-foot bowling alley with a marble-looking miniature bowling ball with actual pins that were in it. The original one that was in there back in the 50s had like some magnetic strips that the ball activated the pins, but these are actual pins on strings. So back for so many years, so many people remember that experience. I mean, I can still hear the sound in my head if I think about it.
A ding ding.
Ding ding. You know, and I mean, you could fit up to six people, and it was just a great thing.
To honor the ding ding machine, there will be a cocktail called the ding ding, with champagne, vodka, a sugar cube, and bitters. The bar will serve vintage cocktails, modeled after the time the bar originally opened, including Hannah's own favorite, the Moscow Mule, which will be served in the traditional copper mug. Mixers will be made in-house, and the beers on tap will be primarily local brews, trying to meet the demands of the new community, while paying respect to Maxine. Rebecca says that every change that they've made is with Maxine in mind.
We think, what would Maxine think of these lights? What would she think of this paint? And we really are trying to honor her and her spirit, just like Hannah was saying. She was a tough woman. She was a shrewd and smart woman. And so all the changes that we're making are definitely with her in mind, her memory in mind.
Maxine was a good businesswoman, and they think she would approve of the changes. Rebecca says that the bar needs to transform, just as Fayetteville has. Her Fayetteville has changed. She came young and single, now has a family. When we spoke, she held two-week-old Beatrix in her arms. But that doesn't mean she doesn't want to go out, socialize, have a drink.
We wanted something that kind of appeals to people that, like me, were 21 in Fayetteville. We did the Dixon Street scene, we did the music scene, and now here we are a little bit older. Maybe we don't need to be out on Dixon until 2 in the morning, but we still want to have a place where we can go and have a nice fancy drink and not have to necessarily deal with the college crowd on Dixon Street. So to me, I don't know, maybe it's Fayetteville's kind of growing up with the people that are growing up within it. That's just kind of what it feels like.
After the grand opening Monday, April Fool's Day, no joke, Maxine's will be open Tuesday through Saturday from 4 p.m. until 2 a.m. For more information, search Facebook for Maxine's Tap Room.
Asa Hutchinson, who lost his bid for governor in 2006, is seeking the job again in 2014. Last week, the former congressman spoke with Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas about his reasons for going for the public office. His resume includes not just his time in the United States House, but also a 10-year stint as a U.S. attorney and undersecretary in the Department of Homeland Security, and a three-time candidate for statewide office. Roby Brock asked why, after losing those races, is he running for another state office?
Well, it's a different state. I mean, Arkansas has changed its politics. I joke that ASA hasn't changed, but the state's changed. And obviously, it's an open race instead of a very strong candidate. Mike Beebe has done a very good job in managing this state as governor. He's very popular as attorney general, a long career here in Arkansas politics, a very formidable opponent, obviously. But I think what it manifests is a consistent desire on my part and a commitment of my wife Susan and I for the state of Arkansas. We left Washington for a good reason. We wanted to come back, build our future here in this state, and continue to contribute to this state and to build it to make it the great place that it is and can be better for our children.
I don't have to tell you, Governor Mike Beebe enjoys very strong job approval ratings, very strong favorable ratings. Are you part of the 98% that believes he has done a good job as governor? How do you rank his performance as governor?
Well, there's always areas that you would disagree and you'd do differently, but by and large, the first responsibility of a governor is to manage the state. And he has managed the state, from a financial standpoint, from a leadership standpoint. So there's some things I've disagreed, a lot that I've agreed with him on. But I think we should applaud his efforts. I think we'll talk about the Big River Steel Project. That's one example where he's leaned forward and trying to bring jobs to this state.
Let's talk about, you've got a primary opponent. Curtis Coleman has announced that he's going to seek the GOP nomination. There could be others. Curtis Coleman, a little bit more aligned with the Tea Party conservatives in the state of Arkansas. I think people would perhaps bookend you in, as an establishment Republican. You've paid your dues for a number of decades here. You mentioned that the state's different. How do you think a Republican primary is going to be different now in terms of the type of voter that comes out, and do you appeal to that base?
Well, let's look back at my career, first of all. I engaged with the Republican Party when we were extreme minority in this state, believing that a two-party system is helpful. And I think going back to Governor Clinton, I don't think many people consider me the establishment. I've been fighting for change in Arkansas for really decades. And that desire for positive change really continues. But when you look at competing in a Republican primary, we feel comfortable where we are. I think the question is do you have the right values for this state, and can you win in November? And I think you look at those two questions, I think that they will answer that we have the right values and we got the best chance to win in November.
Are you expecting anybody else to get into the GOP primary on the primary side? And regardless of that, are you anticipating a series of debates? How are you going to kind of maybe campaign in that respect?
Well, one, it's very early. I'd just soon all of this be put off another year and still leave a year to campaign. But that's the nature of politics these days. You have to start early in fundraising and every aspect. So, it's wide open. There could be others that will jump in. I do not desire to have a bitter Republican primary. I don't think we will. I want to have a campaign about ideas. So we'll see how the field develops, but it's very unusual because it's an open seat. We don't have an incumbent governor that's running. So there's a lot of interest in it. It impacts our state. We're going to, obviously, we've always debated. And so that's the nature of campaigns, and it's important for the candidates to stand side by side and to hear them talk about the issues.
You are the designated front runner in this race. Our Talk Business poll shows you leading Bill Halter, 47-31%. Shows you leading a hypothetical Mike Ross, who may get in the race, 43-38%. Asa Hutchinson in front runner, not always put in the same sentence.
I don't even know how to act. I've never been in that position before. Perhaps when I ran for Congress the first time I got elected, but. Polls I'm used to, and they're sort of dreadful in the sense that the media really likes to cover polls and fundraising, probably the two most unpleasant parts of politics. I wish they'd measure you more carefully on the issues and some of those things, but we're pleased with that, particularly whenever I've been in the private sector for the last 6 years. I've been running businesses, my law practice. And so I haven't been in the public eye. And so to be in this position early on is gratifying. I think it reflects some reservoir of goodwill across the state that we've generated through decades of service.
Let's talk about some issues. Bill Halter was on this show just last week, rolled out the Arkansas Promise, basically a college education plan. If you make a 2.5 grade point average, you get tuition paid at an Arkansas school. Do you support that proposal?
Well, first of all, I applaud him for a serious policy initiative. I read it, and it's creative. Obviously addresses a problem and a challenge that we have. And so those are the kind of issue discussions that we ought to welcome in a campaign. As far as supporting it, we've got a challenge with our young people and obviously bringing them to a four-year college or a two-year college, encouraging graduation rates, and then the cost of it. Is this solution? I have some hesitancy about the cost of it and embarking on a expansion of the lottery scholarship that's already shaky, I would say, and the legislature's having to scale back the scholarships based upon that. So I think we have to look at it very carefully. We do want to address the concern about college graduation rates. We want to look at the costs of it. So we welcome the debate on that and applaud him for that initiative.
But you're down as a maybe right now. So
well, I'm not a maybe in support of it, but he's addressing a serious problem. And we need to come up with a plan that encourages work. It does encourage responsibility with our young people as well. I went to college on a student loan that was government guaranteed, and I paid it back over the course of years, and I worked part-time through college, and our students are willing to do that. And we also want to look at our colleges to make sure that they're doing what they can to keep tuition rates low. Does the plan that Mr. Halter proposed accomplish all of that? We want to make sure that we follow those values and that we don't increase the debt, an unknown debt for the future that will be the next generation's responsibility.
A big subject we could spend half a day talking about. Let's talk about the steel mill super project. You just saw Grant Tenniel on set just before our segment here. 525 jobs, $1.1 billion project, requires some state incentives and initiatives to get this off the ground. Do you think that that is the type of project you would try to recruit as governor of the state of Arkansas?
Absolutely. That's project that creates high-paying jobs, obviously in the Delta region of the state that needs jobs, and it's in a industry that has good growth potential. It's in manufacturing, and we need to expand our manufacturing base in Arkansas. You look at Fort Smith, where I spent 19 years. They've lost Whirlpool. They've lost manufacturing jobs, so we look for opportunities to bring them back. But any investment like this, the legislature is doing the right thing, having a due diligence review. Let's see that if the promises can be kept of creation of 500 jobs, 75,000, if there's a reasonable return on the investment for the taxpayers of Arkansas. We have to be able to accept some risk, but it needs to be a thought out risk, and we share it with the equity holders as well.
Let's talk about health insurance. We've seen a big debate up at the legislature about taking basically Medicaid money, using it in a private health insurance exchange that is part of the Obamacare plan. Do you like the direction that debate is moving? Do you think that that is going to be a problem solver?
Well, the challenge is that either way, whether you take the Medicaid expansion or the private sector or the insurance exchange option, you're still talking about a lot of money, a lot of taxpayers' money. But it is expanding health care, which is consistent with what the Supreme Court has said needs to be done under Obamacare. So I like the direction of the debate because it's looking at a novel way to take the expansion of health care, which is our responsibility now, but doing it with some private sector options, which is the private insurance exchange. Obviously, we need to, the legislature and the governor needs to continue to negotiate this, to fine-tune that, to see what the risks are to Arkansas, but I much prefer combining a private sector equation in this solution versus simply a government solution.
We got about 60 seconds left. What else do you want to bring to the forefront in terms of policy as governor?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, when you talk about job creation, which is critical, and by the way, on the Big River Steel project, we're all looking for a way to support that. And I think the legislature wants to approve that project, but we've got some questions that still need to be answered. We got to expand on that, and it's entrepreneurs in our state that create the jobs. We need to have a climate that entrepreneurs can produce those kind of jobs that have made us grow as a state. So it's certainly our tax competitiveness with other states in the surrounding region. It's our pursuit of super projects. It's our increasing opportunities in education.
Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S., Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, March 31st, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And joining us now is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Happy Easter Sunday.
Happy Easter.
I want to go look for some eggs.
Did the Easter Bunny come see you?
No, the Easter Bunny's coming this afternoon.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Good.
We had to make an appointment.
Okay.
Big time of year for bunnies. New exhibit at the Shiloh Museum.
What is it?
Opens on the 8th. And it is about a family in Springdale named Reed. Okay, you've heard the name Holcomb.
I have. Yeah,
Holcomb like Street.
Holcomb Elementary.
Holcomb Elementary. Well, the Reeds married the Holcombs.
Okay.
The Holcombs go clear back to the beginning of Springdale.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
In fact, they think now that instead of being called Shiloh, that perhaps the first thing Springdale was called was Holcomb's Spring.
Okay.
Reeds married the Holcombs. And on we go. The Reeds have become an exhibit because Henrietta Holcomb, for whom the school is named,
mm-hmm.
her family wanted to bring the Reeds to some attention. And as it turned out, the Reeds made the perfect everyday family. Mm-hmm. That's how Susan Young put it. And so they found, sort of like when my father-in-law was digging up all the pieces of Pettigrew's past, they found parts of Springdale in their family memories. And so it's turned into this, not only a photo exhibit, because there was there were almost no photos, but they've extrapolated, well, this was an Ozark woman, and so she would use these tools in her everyday life. So they've pulled out of the archives in the basement things like a kettle.
Like an iron or...
Right, to illustrate the first three generations of this family. And what Susan Young said she found was that the family was all about family, farming, faith, and education. Lots of teachers, lots of work in the church. Really interesting story and a really interesting way to encourage people to save their family history. You know, not to throw away that particularly ephemera, which museum people love. Mm-hmm. Blotters that used to be used in banks. You know, when you blotted the ink that was ink out of a well.
Oh,
And they were advertising pieces. Things like that that people find now and throw away. Well, the Martins don't find it and throw it away, but other people do. And apparently the Reeds didn't either. This exhibit opens on April 8th, and you'll learn all sorts of things you didn't know. There's going to be a reception that day, I believe that's a Monday, to honor Henrietta Reed Holcomb. And you can find out more at 750-8165. And this afternoon, it's not too late for that rabbit. There's an egg hunt at 2 o'clock at War Eagle Mill. An egg hunt at 2 o'clock at City Park in Heifel. And tonight, the UA Jazz Combos perform at the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall at the University at 6 o'clock. Some funk, some bebop, and some music for spring.
Sounds good.
It does. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Steel Magnolias, Goodbye Charlie, Rumors, Anything Goes, and Next to Normal are just a few of the theater options coming up in the month of April. And April 6th and 7th, the 6th annual spring production from the University of Arkansas's African and African American Studies program will be presented. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums attended a rehearsal last week and filed this report for a daily edition of Ozarks.
But we'll work spots today just because we have some spacing issues, and we'll figure it out. I know we have to meet in here again.
Last night, Clinicia Sibley, assistant professor of drama at the University of Arkansas, was working with her small cast in a small room. Because so many productions are in rehearsal the first days after spring break, finding space to practice on campus may require a night or two in a makeshift location. Last night, the cast and crew of Waiting to be Invited snuggled inside the Office of African and African American Studies in office space on the edge of campus. Clinicia Sibley has four of her actors work and rework a pivotal scene when four African American women in 1964 Atlanta decide they can summon the courage to enter a whites-only department store.
I come out from work last Friday. About the last one to leave. My son looking half scared to death. My daughter hysterical when I got to him. My car all scratched up. Dog marks on both sides. Ruth, they stick the dogs on my children.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the path.
Before the cast arrived last night, Clinicia Sibley, herself a playwright, sat down to talk about this sixth annual spring production from the African and African American Studies program.
It's wonderful because I teach African American theater history and dramatic literature. And so this is an interesting way to kind of explore my classroom material and to get my students to have unique opportunities to see this type of culturally specific theater. So I enjoy it, and I actually remember being a grad student and seeing some of the African American Studies professors do a production of Ntozake Shange's play For Colored Girls. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what year that was, but that was the first time I saw this program being affiliated with that type of annual play or that type of initiative. And I said, if I ever hang around, I would love to sort of, you know, have that as, you know, a baby and to be able to nurture that initiative and to see it grow every year. So that was when I was a grad student here. And, you know, now sort of being the leader of this, it's wonderful. I love it.
She selects the script each year. This year's, Waiting to Be Invited by S.M. Shepherd Massat, received the Kennedy Center's Roger L. Stevens Award for a work by a new playwright and earned Ms. Massat the Kennedy Award for Most Promising Young Dramatist. Clanisha says she considers a wide range of factors when she chooses a play for each spring.
We want to serve the African and African American studies students. We want to serve that group and allow them to be active participants in this initiative. But we also, because I am in the drama department, you know, I want to offer opportunities to students who are in that world. And then you have some of the drama majors and minors paired with the African and African American Studies program students. So you kind of think about the students that are going to be really drawn to this opportunity. And I find that it helps, that it informs the plays that I sort of select.
The cast, except for one actor, is made up of undergraduate students. Perhaps it's not quite accurate to say the civil rights events of the 1960s are ancient history to them, but certainly 1964 represents a different America. Clanisha Sibley says directing students is always a teaching opportunity, and she wants to nurture the artistic talents of her cast, she says, but she wants the annual spring production to tie into course material as well.
This is the first year we have someone serving in the role as dramaturg. So the research that he's been conducting has, you know, has been so vital to our process. And it helps the students to be able to put together those historical pieces or the information that they might be very removed from. But I've picked that up in last year's production. We did a play called The Colored Museum by George C. Wolfe. And we realized that we took a lot of time to establish character and a historical backdrop in our rehearsal process. Before we knew it, we had put so much time into trying to understand the material and what that material meant historically. So this year we created that role of the dramaturg and said, this is something that we need to have every year. We need to have a student, and there are so many students that are here for history that have that interest in either dramatic literature research or research related to African American history. So why not get that student who's specifically involved in that area to serve us in this way and just to continue to build on the knowledge that they're hungry for.
Clanisha, who is not that far removed from earning her own MFA, says she's learned a bit in the past few years, too. She says she used to have a desire to direct her own scripts.
I've learned a lot in the last few years about you know, being focused on a single artistic goal. But I do find that creating theater as a playwright and creating theater and moments as a director are significantly different.
Waiting to Be Invited will have two productions in the Arkansas Union Theater on the U of A campus, Saturday night, April 6th at 7:30, and Sunday afternoon, April 7th at 2:30. Saturday night will include a talk back with the audience to discuss the play. Clanisha Sibley says she expects that to be an interesting component of the weekend because she thinks this play will draw audience members from multiple generations.
And that's going to be the beauty of the talk back. That's how it was last year, too. We did a play that was, you know, different. There were different snippets of African-American history. And so you had things that college students were relating to. You had things professors were relating to. Community people were relating to. Everyone was relating. And when it came to having a conversation about these thematic elements or these plot elements in the play, you had opportunities for teaching moments for the young and old. So you're absolutely right. This is a this is a meeting of generations, and I'm excited and thrilled that these college students have had the opportunity to go back into history, and it ultimately gives them a sense of pride about themselves and their current situation.
Clanisha Sibley is an assistant professor of theater at the University of Arkansas and the director of the 6th annual spring production sponsored by the University of Arkansas Office of African and African American Studies. Both performances are free and open to the public.
Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kelms filed that report for a daily edition of Ozarks earlier this week.
Later today on This American Life, Andrea's head tingles, and I mean it literally tingles, when she hears the sound of typing, the flipping of pages, or people talking like this.
This is gentle whispering.
Now then, barely touch the canvas.
I'm going to share something personal.
Andrea always thought that she was the only one who felt these tingles. But was she? Later today.
This American Life, just ahead at 10 o'clock here on KUAF.
The nonprofit Merlin Foundation, now in its 20th year of operation, assists children victimized by physical or sexual abuse living across a 6-county region in North Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich brings us their story.
Merlin Leach retired to the Ozarks in 1992 to Southern Carroll County from Los Angeles after a long career helping children suffering with cancer. He envisioned building a retreat center for families who've lost a child to catastrophic illness. He has a PhD in degenerative diseases and worked in behavioral medicine for many years, also assisting families struggling with illness and domestic abuse. But when local law enforcement and the county judiciary learned about Merlin Leach's skill set, they tapped him to assist children trapped in impossible circumstances.
There were no services whatsoever for child abuse, domestic violence, or rape, meaning adult rape. And would I get something started?
Not only did Merlin Leach get something started, he drew attention to a critical need. Over the next decade, the Merlin Foundation let go of full family advocacy work, leaving that to new agencies which blossomed around the region in order to focus strictly on children rescued from sexual assault and domestic violence situations.
Originally it was funded by my wife and I, but I think our first year's donations were like $2,500 or something, which hardly gets anything going. But we're public funded. We apply for grants, but our big support, we have to say thank you, Walton Family, Walmart, and the whole crowd, Arvest Bank, everything with a Walton name on it. If it weren't for them, we wouldn't have got here. We wouldn't be here.
According to the records on file with the Arkansas Attorney General's office, monetary grants, gifts, and contributions have fluctuated over the years to the Merlin Foundation between $90,000 to $200,000 annually, most of it public support. Yet, the foundation accomplishes so much with so little. For example, staff are on call 24/7 to assess traumatized children taken into police custody. Michelle Steiner, a licensed practical nurse and executive director of the Merlin Foundation, serves as a forensic interviewer.
A forensic interview is where a child who has allegations of maltreatment is talked to in a very developmental and fact-finding manner about what they may have experienced. My training enables me to be able to talk to children in a way that is developmentally sensitive and non-intimidating, just to be able to help them through that process.
Following a strict protocol to build rapport and assess a child's ability, Steiner is able to gather information for community partners investigating the case. For example, local police, domestic violence agencies, or the County Department of Human Services. Medical and psychiatric providers may also pitch in. The children are not interviewed in a holding area by big men in dark uniforms at the county jail. Rather, they're transported to a place called Grandma's House in Green Forest, where Michelle Steiner, using toys and games and play therapy, coaxes critical case information from the children.
And part of that process as well is establishing a common language with identifying body parts. And then we talk about touches that they like to get and touches that they don't like to get. And from there, there's a process in which if there's an abuse which has been disclosed from the child at that time, then we'll go in and help that child to be able to talk about what they've experienced just in a very fact-finding manner. And then at the end of the interview, we will, what we call a respectful closure, you know, helping the child and educating them whether they have made a disclosure or have not made a disclosure, who they could talk to if something has or does happen to them, you know, who they can safely tell.
Because most of these children don't end up in state care. They're returned to their family of origin, whose members also go through intervention. Authorities believe removing children from family homes is only a last resort. Grandma's House is one of six children's advocacy centers in Arkansas operating in compliance with the standards of the National Children's Alliance and the state serving abused and neglected children. And despite the name, Grandma's House, the work inside is extremely intense, with most cases involving some form of sexual abuse.
It is intense work, and, you know, for me, we get to work with some of the most wonderful people in the world, and most of them are short, you know, just to be able to help them through that process, you know, it's so rewarding, and, you know, in their own way, they give back to us, you know, just the same as we would to them.
More than 800 children and family members were helped in 2011 by the Merlin Foundation. Now, Merlin Leach, he stepped down from the foundation 4 years ago to attempt retirement once again. And the presence of the Merlin Foundation in the six-county region has helped quell domestic violence and abuse in the community, Leach says.
In the very beginning, the very first year we started at, 94, in Carroll County, we had 150-some-odd cases went through that multidisciplinary team. We had no CAC in those days. We probably don't see 100 cases a year now in Carroll County.
But like every nonprofit community service organization these days, the Merlin Foundation needs financial help to meet its mission. To that end, a group of Carroll County women are throwing a big party, a Goddess Gala, April 2nd, a Tuesday night in downtown Eureka Springs at the Basin Park Hotel to benefit Merlin Leach, his staff, the foundation, and the children. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
More information is available at goddessgala.com and merlinfoundation.com.
Today is Easter, and we celebrate the holiday in today's montage, but not with the religious celebration, but rather the Easter Bunny. See if you can recognize these eight Easter Bunny and rabbit-related snippets from pop culture.
You're looking at a very unusual kind of egg.
Does Elwood see anybody these days?
Oh, yes, Aunt Ethel. Elwood sees somebody.
Yes, Aunt Ethel, he does.
And now, Aunt Ethel, I'd like you to meet Harvey. Harvey, you've heard me speak of Aunt Ethel Chauvenet. She's one of my oldest and dearest friends.
Who's Harvey?
A white rabbit, 6 feet tall.
6 feet?
6 feet, 3.5 inches. Now, let's stick to the facts.
Have some fruit-flavored tricks for me?
We have tricks as part of a delicious breakfast.
Jolly good, maybe.
Tricks fruit taste is jolly good.
Tricks has fruit taste I like. There's lemon, there's orange in every bite.
Yay! A rabbit! Silly rabbit, tricks for kids.
Yo ho ho, it's always no.
mother gives you, don't do it.
What? What the hell?
Stop jumping, Bear Rabbit. You'll run out of breath. Why don't you sit down and calm yourself?
Where's the grasshopper, Jump? Supposed to be free. I do what I like and I suit me.
To see how you did or to listen again, just go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
Support for KUAF comes from The Amp, presenting country music vocal artists Little Big Town and opening act David Nail Friday, April 19th. Little Big Town brings their hits Boondocks, Bring It On Home, and Pontoon to Northwest Arkansas. Tickets and more information available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Easter Creek.
Where's that?
Easter Creek is in Johnson County, and it is just north of Oark. It isn't actually, you know, we like to name towns, and
sure.
It isn't actually a town.
Well, it's a thing.
But it's a thing, and it's Easter, so.
I'm okay with that.
There you go.
I'm okay with that. Big plans for Easter?
Not really. I'm going to a family barbecue for my boyfriend's family this afternoon, but not, you know, not like a sit-down Easter dinner, really.
Yeah, me neither.
So.
I feel like we did stuff growing up, but I think as people have gotten older and busier and stuff,
yeah,
it's not necessarily an every year thing.
I know.
So, but barbecues are always fun.
Mm-hmm.
So
no, it'll be a good
hopefully the weather holds up so you can be outside.
Mm-hmm. Should be nice. I know I miss the days of having an Easter basket. Outgrown those. Oh, well.
Well, okay. If we don't get an Easter basket by the end of the day, tomorrow you and I will go to the store.
And get Easter candy.
Okay. That's on sale. And we can even get a basket to put it in.
Okay. We'll have it on the front desk. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and we'll need it because our on-air fundraiser begins tomorrow, so we'll need the sugar to
keep us going.
Keep us going. Yeah. So I guess we're ready.
We're ready to talk to our listeners and ask them to continue their support of or become new members if they have not been a contributing listener yet. We begin tomorrow. And we will go through April 10th. We'll be on the air different times. You'll be able to hear Christina and I at different points throughout the day instead of just on Ozarks. You'll hear us on Ozarks at Large. But during other shifts of the day, you'll be able to hear us as well.
Right. And then some voices that you don't always hear, like station manager Rick Stockdale. You know, you hear him during the fundraisers. And so he'll be on tomorrow. And then Rhonda Dillard also, our underwriting director.
She'll be on a little bit. And I know Molly Ron, she'll be on a little bit our
Membership director.
She'll be on a little bit too. And you'll get to hear from several of the folks that work here and do our best to bring you the programming that you enjoy and have come to rely on.
Yes. Okay. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And this week we'll be all together for Monday's Ozarks at Large. Kyle Kellums, you and I. And
so we look forward to talking to you guys tomorrow.
Okay. Happy Sunday.